Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Sharika Crawford, your host. Today, I'm with Dr. Lucas Stanek. He's a senior lecturer at the Manchester School of Architecture at the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom. We're here to discuss his newest book, Architecture and Global Socialism, Eastern Europe, West Africa, and the Middle East in the Cold War, published by Princeton University Press in 2020. Lucas, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you, Sharika.
Thank you for agreeing to do this interview.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let us begin with you and your background. Where are you from and how did you become interested in architecture and architectural history?
I'm an architectural historian, and so I'm very interested in buildings and in the users. But I also graduated in philosophy, which makes me very interested in concepts too. And in terms of where I come from, I had a rather peripatetic trajectory. So I studied in Poland, in Germany, in Switzerland. I did my PhD in the Netherlands. And then I held various academic positions in Paris and Zurich and Washington and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and now since 8 years at the University of Manchester in the UK.
With such an international, lived experience, I'm curious to hear you explain what drew your attention to Eastern Europe and their engagements in West Africa and the Middle East in the mid to late 20th century. And if you also could tie that into what is your book about?
Sure. So maybe I start with the latter. The book shows how during the Cold War, architects, planners, and quite importantly, construction companies from socialist countries in Eastern Europe collaborated with their counterparts in West Africa and the Middle East. And so in that sense, the book documents how the urbanization processes in a number of places in the Global South were shaped by this collaboration between what would be called at this time the second and the third world. And in particular, I focus on five cities in specific periods of the Cold War histories, namely Accra during the first decade of independence under President Kwame Nkrumah, so between 1957 and 1966, and then Lagos in Nigeria in the 1970s in the wake of the Civil War and during the oil boom, Baghdad in Iraq, from the 1960s to the 1980s, and finally Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait City during the 1980s. And so the context of these processes was decolonization and the Cold War, when the untangling of Western European empires opened the newly independent countries to resources and expertise beyond the West. And it was at the time that many leaders in Africa and Asia exploited the rivalry between the United States, the Soviet Union, and the other. Some among them, such as Nkrumah in Ghana, and to some extent also the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, were attracted to the Soviet offer because they pursued the socialist model of development with the emphasis on state-centered industrialization, collectivization of agriculture, and justice-oriented welfare distribution. But it's quite important for my book that these exchanges were not simply restricted to Soviet allies, because this collaboration with between the post-colonial countries and the socialist countries was also attractive to those Asian and African governments that did not follow the socialist model of development. And so, for example, I discussed Nigerian authorities and the Gulf, and these countries too welcomed professionals and companies from the socialist countries as a means to stimulate economic competition between foreign enterprises in the country.
And how did you come to become interested in these exchanges between these socialist, Eastern European architects and their, you know, interactions and their work and collaborations in West Africa and the Middle East? Was it drawn from previous work?
Right. Yes. The sort of anecdotal beginning of this research, which took over a decade, was my really very first, if you like, research project, which I started already as a student, and that project focused on Nowa Huta, which is a socialist new town in post-war Poland. It was constructed since the late 1940s, and that town was designed by a large design institute, which was called Miasto Projekt. And when I looked at its work, I realized that the following large project by this design institute was the master plan of Baghdad in the 1960s. And it was very intriguing to me. And I looked at it in more depth. And then when I was offered to curate an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in Warsaw, and the topic was really left to me, I suggested that topic as the topic of the exhibition. And so the exhibition, which opened 10 years ago, was really quite relevant for me. It allowed me to gather first archival materials to conduct the first interviews, but it also made me realize how controversial this topic was in Poland. And this was only confirmed when I started on working on this topic and traveled to other countries in the region, from Germany to Russia, from Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, to the countries of the former Yugoslavia.
Your work in particular speaks to multiple scholarly communities. And I was interested in hearing you discuss how your case studies, these five case studies, might help us to better understand 20th century architectural history, but also Cold War history.
Yeah, that's right. I think that my immediate disciplinary concern is really the question of a possibility of a more global history of architecture, and perhaps more generally a more global history of urbanization. I think that today there are two dominant frameworks for such histories. On the one hand, there is research which one can call perhaps post-colonial urbanism. So that's the research which studies the consequences of the colonial encounter and colonial violence for the production, appropriation, and imagination of spaces. And this research centers on the dialectics of the colonized and the colonizer. On the other hand, there is something which perhaps can be called a word system theory approach, which studies the diffusion of architecture and construction technology from centers to the peripheries. And this approach, centers of global capitalism, assumes to be global centers of architectural expertise. And both narratives are largely shaping architectural history today, at least architectural history as it is produced in the global north. But I think that it do not really give justice to the material and to the phenomena that were happening in particular in the post-colonial period. And the blind spots are very easily recognizable. For instance, these blind spots can be seen even in the specific historiographies of specific cities. Baghdad, for instance, has received a lot of attention of architectural historians. But this attention is really focused on the work of Western architects in Baghdad in the 1950s and then again in the 1980s. By contrast, the two decades between so the 1960s and the 1970s, which is the very period when Iraq was closely allied to socialist countries and had perhaps a more antagonistic relationship with the West, these two decades were largely omitted in Western scholars. And so in both frameworks, really the agency of the West is foregrounded, or the agency of the global North at the expense of other actors, notably those from the global South. The agency is quite often reduced to that spectrum between reception and resistance. And from my point of view, it's also perhaps quite useful to point out that in these two frameworks, Eastern Europe doesn't really fit very well either to either of these two frameworks. It is not because colonialism or global capitalism were not relevant for this region, but rather because Eastern Europe cannot be easily assigned a specific role within these two frames. So it can be seen, or should be seen, both as a colonizing and as a colonizer, and at the same time doesn't quite fit that opposition between centers and peripheries of world capital. And so, in a way, the ambition of my book is really to move beyond these two explanatory schemes and complicate them. And that complication is really, you know, a response of what I have read in my archival materials and what I've heard in my interviews. And so, for instance, when Eastern Europeans were arriving to Ghana and to Nigeria, they were very much complicated. That dialectics between the European colonizer and the African colonizer. And their presence made it evident, you know, mainly evident to Ghanaians and to Nigerians, that this dialectics was neither as comprehensive nor as encompassing as one might think.
I absolutely felt that as I was reading, that you were very much attuned to this kind of centrality of the agency of the West, and your work, your argumentation, your evidence really speaks to the ways that Eastern Europe as a region and these particular architects don't really fit into these frames, and also the architects, the political figures and leaders who are inviting and working with these Eastern European architects and urban planners, whether in the Middle East or in West Africa, they themselves have a centrality of agency in this collaboration. And I was really excited to see this throughout your five case studies. I think that it might be helpful for our listeners that we talk a little bit about a concept that you explained very early on in your introduction, and your book in some ways hinges on this whole concept, this idea of socialist world making, in order for readers to understand how the intervention of Eastern European socialist countries in West Africa and the Middle East triggered this dynamic that you just alluded to, this process of antagonism and difference. Could you help our listeners understand this concept of world making and how it's linked to your overarching argument?
Yes. So this concept is inspired by the writings of several authors, including Henri Lefebvre, Edouard Glisson, and others, not only Francophone authors, also, for instance, by scholars in urban studies today, such as Ananya Roy or Aigwe Ong. But starting with the previous ones, Lefebvre, who, as you know, was a French philosopher and sociologist, he wrote in the 1970s about what he called mondialisation. And this is a term that normally we would translate as globalization into English. But for Lefebvre, that meant more than what is usually associated with globalization. So more than deregulation of financial systems and industrialization beyond the West, the increasing economic integration of global trade and new information communication technologies. He did mention all that, but also wrote about other things, about ecological threats on a planetary scale, and about what he termed the right to the city movements on which were emerging on all continents. But the main point was that the word for Lefebvre was really a dimension of practice an experience and a project. And so mondialisation was making was that process of the emergence of the world as a dimension of practice. And to my mind, this thinking was advanced by the Martinican poet and writer and theorist Edouard Glissant, who defined the world not by the logic of expansions, which is very much like the core of an imperialist or colonialist imagination of the world, of what the world is. You know, the horizon is always a threat. And for Glissant, that was not the case. For you know, writing at the end of the Cold War, Glissant thought about the world as a multiplication of possibilities of connection. And so following these authors and those whom I mentioned before in very contemporary debates in urban studies, I'm really insisting in my book on the difference between world-making and globalization. And so globalization in the sense of, in which the term has been used since the 1970s in Anglo-American scholarship is just one among many possibilities of world-making. And socialist, internationalist, and the non-aligned movement were really other possibilities, and the book is really about that.
Well, how about we turn our attention now to a few of your cases? You have five cases, five cities that you examined, Accra, Lagos, Baghdad, you have a Kuwait City, and Abu Dhabi. And I think we should probably begin with your first case study, which opens up with these Polish and Hungarian Yugoslav architects working in Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana in the late 50s and 60s. How should we come to understand Eastern European engagement with the first sub-Saharan African country to gain independence?
Well, exactly. As you just said, this was Ghana was a really important place in the 1960s, the late 1950s and the 1960s, and a place that was such an inspiring place for so many people in Africa, but not only in Africa. And also because of that symbolic meaning of the first African country in sub-Saharan Africa, the first independent country, because of that symbolic meaning, it was really also the focus of Soviet policy and Soviet diplomacy. And for the Soviets, Ghana and a number of other West African countries in the early 1960s were key places to promote the socialist development path. And so what this chapter does is to discuss those modes of adapting the Soviet construction industry, but also much broader economy and the vision of a society to a condition of tropical Africa, and you know, very specifically Ghana and a number of Ghanaian cities. This includes architecture, planning, construction technologies, but also questions of ways of life, climate, and social and economic conditions. Only few of these investments were completed because they were interrupted by the coup which took Nkrumah in 1966, but they were really important in Ghana and beyond. But really the key point of this chapter is not that question of adaptation of the Soviet models, but rather the fact that this architectural production in Nkrumah's Ghana was not at all dominated by the Soviet Union. Rather, in charge of this production were Ghanaian professionals, such as, for instance, the architect Vic Adegbite, and Ghanaian institutions, such as the Ghana National Construction Corporation, or GNCC, which is really the focus of the chapter. And the GNCC employed a number of Ghanaian architects, and Vic Adegbite was the head architect there, but it also employed a large number of Eastern European architects, Polish, Hungarian, Yugoslav, Bulgarian, and so on. And their work resulted in such prominent ensembles in Accra as, for instance, the International Trade Fair, and a number of other really both landmark buildings, but also much more modest housing neighborhoods, social facilities, cultural facilities, health institutions, and so on. And so what this chapter does is really to look at this co-production of architecture by Ghanaians and foreigners and how they tapped into competing networks of architectural expertise and resources that intersected in Ghana in the 1990s.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, I was very struck by the Ghanaian government's, I wouldn't say eagerness, but openness to these particular collaborations and the ways in which they still both mediated kind of the larger geopolitics of Ghana at that time in the Cold War, but also the ways in which they, you know, really asserted their control over the production of architectural you know, policies and products at that time. And I was hoping, just as kind of a quick follow-on, that you might talk a little bit about something that you mentioned in your book, which was there was a sort of competition in Ghana. The Hungarian and the Yugoslav and, you know, these kind of Soviet satellite places were on the scene, but you still had the British also trying to influence and still, you know, take a slice of what would be this kind of post-colonial African state.
Yeah, yes, that's right. I think architecture is very specific, but I think a relevant entrance point to discussing this competition. And I think you are really very, very right to say about the openness of the Ghanaian decision makers. I think it's important to keep in mind, and I was reminded about this over and over again, that these Ghanaian administrators and politicians and decision makers were had this often incredible experience of cosmopolitanism, right? Most of them, of course, all of them studied abroad, and quite often not in one country but in several. And so they themselves had that experience of perhaps a relativistic perspective, the ability to compare and to choose from various positions. And the whole chapter is really about that possibility and that agency of Ghanaian decision makers, for whom independence was really quite often that experience of an opening towards the world, right? Where Britain is no longer the only center of expertise, including architectural and planning and technological expertise, but this British expertise is now being juxtaposed with many other sources, and there is really a discussion, a debate, and quite often antagonism between these positions. That is liberating, but it is also risky, right? Because the stakes are incredibly high. The stakes to create an independent country were incredibly high, and in many ways the fate of Nkrumah is really a reminder of how high these stakes were. And so these discussions between, and this very direct competition sometimes, you know, which takes place in a form of literally architectural competitions between various architects located in Ghana and Accra at this time. This competition is really the reality of much of what is going on in architecture in Ghana in the 1960s. And that included architects coming from a number of places, from Eastern Europe, from England, but also, for instance, really fascinating story of architects coming from the United States, notably African American, who arrived to Ghana to support Nkrumah.
Your next case focuses on another West African country, that of Nigeria, in the preceding decade, in 1970s. And I think our listeners might be interested in hearing how these Eastern European architects and urban planners, how their experiences in Nigeria differed from that of Ghana. And then how did Nigerians view these architectural exchanges?
That's right. So Ghana was really, really different from Nigeria. In difference to Ghana, Nigerian elites were generally hostile towards socialism, and they were not attracted by socialist development path. Rather, the presence of Eastern Europeans in Nigeria resulted from attempts of the federal government to diversify foreign actors, to stimulate competition between them. And that had a lot of consequences, of course, for the way Eastern Europeans and their Nigerian counterparts worked. So, for instance, what was very clear was that the aim of the work in Nigeria was not at all the implementation of a socialist path of development. And that meant that the Polish, Yugoslav, Bulgarian, Hungarian Soviet architects who were there sought for other ways of making sense for the tasks at hand. And this is really the core of that chapter. So that the chapter is about how Eastern Europeans and West Africans, Nigerians in this case, imagined the world which they shared in a very speculative and sometimes experimental manner. And I argue that in looking for those shared worlds, they pointed out at the shared historical experience, namely the experience of foreign domination over Eastern Europe and over Sub-Saharan Africa during the long 19th century. And that history of domination contributed in both regions to economic backwardness and to cultural dependency. Quite importantly, this is not just a question of legitimizing the work or the present and the work of Eastern Europeans in Nigeria. What was at stake here is something much more specific. It was really about the activation, the reactivation of architectural tools from Eastern European architectural culture. These tools had been implemented precisely in response to that predicament of foreign domination, a predicament that was ostensibly shared by Eastern Europeans and West Africans. And so I'm arguing these by means of three case studies. First, a Hungarian plan for Kalabar, which really mobilized the experience of developing rural Hungary in the post-war period. Secondly, Polish-Nigerian survey of vernacular architecture in Nigeria, which went back to the drawing and surveying techniques that were employed in interwar Poland in rural areas. And finally, the case study of the International Trade Fair in Lagos, which is Yugoslav and Nigerian design. And so what this chapter shows is how Eastern Europeans instrumentalize these historical analogies between Eastern Europe and West Africa. But this is also about the danger of such analogies and perhaps the limits of such analogies, which then refer to the ambiguities of Eastern Europe's own colonial history. That comes back to something I said before, right? That Eastern Europe was clearly a region that was arguably colonized by external empires in the 19th century, and perhaps most evidently during World War II. But at the same time, this is a region which has its own colonial fantasies and even colonial practices, including the so-called internal colonization in interwar Poland. And so the travel to Nigeria by the Poles, by Hungarians, and by others confronted them with these ambiguities of their own colonial history.
Yeah, I think this chapter with Nigeria really draws out that line of argumentation that you've mentioned earlier in our interview. And they are kind of a nice contrast, the Ghana and the Nigeria chapters when read together. But your book also looks at the Middle East. And so you move away from West Africa after your chapter on Nigeria, and you turn your attention first to the case of Iraq with Baghdad. And for me, I'm not familiar with Middle Eastern history or this particular part of its architectural history. I found it really fascinating. In some ways, your discussion on Ghana really was a nice setup, because Iraq also developed a sort of a state based on a socialist system. And I was thinking it might be interesting for you to kind of open that conversation with a question, or answering a question such as, what aspirations and then the challenges did Iraqi officials and urban planners have in their attempt to, collaborate with and engage Eastern European architects and urban planners? And then how did the Iraqi government approach this engagement from the Soviet bloc?
Right. Yes, this is a chapter which shows how Iraqi administrators and decision makers and professionals and these categories kind of merge quite often, right? Because major architects quite often become important officials in various ministries and like that. So how these leaders in Baghdad worked with Eastern Europe, with the Soviet Union and other Eastern European countries in order to pursue a particular vision of modernization and development. And what I focus on in this chapter are differences between the various political economies that were at stake. And I, one of the kind of key arguments of the chapter is to show how decision makers and managers and professionals in Iraq exploited the differences between the emerging global market of design and construction services and the political economy of state socialism. So I'm sometimes going into some details by discussing such specific aspects of state socialist political economy as the inconvertibility of currencies, which is part of the larger principle of the state monopoly on foreign trade, but also the principle of barter. So the exchange of goods for good without the mediation of money. And for my purposes, the particularly fascinating example is what can be called petrobarter. So the exchange of crude oil for instance, the buildings. And the chapter shows how these transactions facilitated specific design methodologies and technologies and even programs in Iraq and the region. And so this argument is developed by looking at the master plans of Baghdad, which were delivered by Miasto Project, so the very office I mentioned at the beginning, but also the general housing program for Iraq, which was a huge housing program for the whole country that was developed by the Iraqis and by Miasto Project in the late 1970s. But I'm also looking at the case study, which admittedly is a rather unusual for an architectural historian. Namely, I'm looking at the industrial slaughterhouse in Baghdad, which was designed by East German and constructed by Romania. And I think this is a good case study precisely to look how the collaboration in this triangle, so the Iraqis, the East Germans, and the Romanians work, and how what was the division of labor, and you know, what were the challenges, what were the advantages of this complex setup. And it also look and allows me to look more critically at let's say, you know, official discourse of state socialist countries, question of solidarity, question of global division of labor, what they call the global socialist division of labor, questions of kind of complementarity between the various economies of state socialist countries, and so on. Namely, that case study very clearly shows that much more than coordination and collaboration between socialist countries, there was a lot of competition between them. And that is also very much the case in the final chapter of the book about the GATT.
Lucas, I'm curious, was your chapter on Baghdad, did you write that first? It seemed to be, I mean, the time coverage of these collaborations, engagements were very lengthy from the 50s, you know, for almost 20 or two decades. And then the ways in which you were able to kind of draw out this, you know, these projects of modernization and then the ways in which the collaborations went beyond just coordinating, but, you know, rethinking the division of labor. Was this one of your early chapters that you wrote for the book?
Yes, that was one of the first for me to study. But I studied really at the time when I began the project, I really studied the Polish engagement there. So I really interviewed a number of people who worked in Baghdad, and I managed to interview a number of Iraqi architects, planners, and professors, because that was another big part of this engagement, that Polish architects and planners also taught in various architectural schools in Baghdad and in the same shape, a new generation of Koshe, together with many others, the future generation of Iraqi architects. So that was really the beginning. But and so in a sense, you are right, this was my first chapter. But at the same time, it was also to some extent my last chapter, because this was a chapter I fundamentally rewrote after many years of working on this book, because one of the key ambitions of the book is really not to have that kind of duality, that kind of, you know, bipolarity, meaning, you know, the Poles on the other hand and on the one hand and the Iraqis on the other. I was really interested in having a more comparative perspective on socialist countries. And this is why I selected that Romanian, East German, Iraqi case study. And again, of course, the Poles were still there, and so were many others. But that allowed me to have a more comparative view on what was going on in Baghdad.
Your research is tremendous. Our listeners cannot fully appreciate via this interview the voluminous blueprints and photographs and city planning maps and the interviews that you had to conduct across these five case studies. Could you talk a bit about your research process and how you came to gather the source material to write this impressive study?
Yes, well, thank you. That's why the images are really my key sources, and they are key sources for architectural historians. And in the case of this book, they included all sorts of images that included blueprints and diagrams and engineering drawings and master plans and urban norms and urban standards, photographs of models of buildings, and of course, photographs of finished buildings. And so they were really, really crucial, and I complemented them with other types of sources, such as trade agreements, minutes of discussions, reports from the construction site, and various professional publications. Notably, what was really crucial for me were professional journals, sometimes fairly ephemeral, not only from Eastern Europe, but also from West Africa and the Middle East. In addition to that, I also used daily newspapers, which helped me to fill in some of the missing gaps. So the majority of the images that are published in the book were never published before, And because of the large format of the book, and really, I have to say, the excellent graphic editing that was done by Princeton University Press, the documents reproduced in the book, notably the master plan, can be used by other scholars because they are, you know, legible enough, including the original descriptions. And I gathered these materials from various archives, public, institutional, and private. The private archives included national and municipal archives, and the institutional archives were those of design institutes and construction firms, notably those in West Africa and the Middle East. Some of them were still working today. I also consulted archives of important institutions such as, for instance, the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Kumasi in Ghana. The challenge of these archives, in particular when architectural documentation was concerned, was that they were quite often incomplete, quite often fragmentary. And so this is why it was really crucial for me to gain access to private archives of architects and planners and engineers who worked in the countries I wrote about. And I was, I have to say, I was really lucky and fortunate to get access to many such archives in Eastern Europe, but also to archives of architects from Ghana, from Nigeria, Iraq, the UAE, and Kuwait. And I'm really very grateful to them and to the families who made this incredible material available to me.
No, I mean it's tremendous. As someone who's not an architectural historian, I could appreciate the tremendous effort it must have taken you to acquire so much of this important material, which would be important in the understanding and the analysis of the line of argument you wanted to make about these architectural mobilities. Lucas, I'm curious to hear what. Currently, are you working on? Do you have a small or large project underway?
Well, I'm currently working with the Canadian Center for Architecture as part of the larger Centering Africa project. It is a project which is funded by the Mellon Foundation, and I'm really excited about this. My contribution is focused on the question of Africanization of Ghanaian architecture. As you know, Africanization is a highly controversial term because it was introduced by the colonial regimes, but it was also a term that was used by the post-colonial government. And so I'm really intrigued what Africanization of architecture meant and its dynamics, meaning the emergence and emancipation of indigenous actors in design, construction, planning, administration, and education in Ghana. And so I hope that in some years I will be able to publish on this.
Well, I look forward to reading your work, particularly as it relates to Ghana and its architectural history and legacy. Lucas, I want to thank you for coming on New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Rika.
You can find a link to Architecture and Global Socialism, Eastern Europe, West Africa, and the Middle East in the Cold War on our New Books Network webpage. Until next time.